Welcome to BICOM's weekly podcast. My name is James Serene. I am delighted this week to be joined by Seth Fransman, who is the author of a very, very timely book that has just come out recently called After ISIS, America, Iran, and the Struggle for the Middle East. Seth is a Middle East analyst. He's a journalist at the Jerusalem Post, and he is probably the perfect guest to have on right now to talk about what are the implications for ISIS regrouping in the aftermath of this Turkish invasion of northeast Syria, consolidation by the Assad regime. Russia looks like it's the big power broker, but the story behind the story that's emerging increasingly this week is about what on earth is happening in terms of these crucial detention facilities in Syria that the Kurds were guarding. And they seemed like we heard from Ambassador James Jeffrey in Congress yesterday that as many as 100 ISIS fighters could have escaped. There's a major story this morning in London in the Times that ISIS is, to all intents and purposes, sort of retaking control of the Al-Hal detention sort of camp in northeast Syria. So, I mean, you know, this looks like a very volatile, dangerous situation. I mean, Seth, you sort of studied ISIS. You went on the ground and saw the aftermath of some of the worst ISIS atrocities. I mean, do you think that this is now the case that ISIS is regrouping?
Yeah, look, I think the thing is that we have to understand, you know, ISIS once had at its peak more than 50,000 fighters, and plus you have to add all the families, of which it also attracted, I guess, around 55,000 or so foreign volunteers, including many women and some children who came from abroad, including from Europe. So, you know, ISIS, of course, has been beaten down and defeated. But what happened when it was defeated was around 10,000 of the worst ISIS fighters ended up being detained, most of them in Syria. And something like 40 or 50,000 of the women and children, and some of the women especially, are hardcore ISIS fanatics. So the women are kept in a camp in this place called Al-Hol. In fact, they've created their own religious police inside the camp because the anti-ISIS coalition led by the Americans never bothered to really task its own forces to guard the ISIS prisoners. It's kind of strange, but the coalition never viewed guarding prisoners as its role. So it got the SDF, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, this mostly Kurdish group, to kind of do that. And of course, once the United States decided on October 6th that it would leave part of eastern Syria and allow Turkey to begin bombing this SDF group, and then of course that resulted in what this kind of compromise where the Syrian regime and Russia and Turkey have all agreed to carve things up, it's not a surprise that the ISIS detainees are not being watched very well. Now, it does seem that most of them, still the 10,000 or so of the worst, are still being kept in certain places, but some of them have escaped. I think Jeffrey's numbers actually are low. He says 100 dozens, but actually I think the Kurds claim it's more than 600. And I guess it depends on how you define, you know, who's an ISIS member or an ISIS fighter, because some of the people that escaped were ISIS supporters or fans. But certainly this doesn't look good. And we know for a fact that there's something like 14,000 estimated ISIS members that are already active in Iraq and Syria in these regions. So I assume that this will just bolster their abilities.
And in terms of, you know, what you think they will do and what the capabilities are for various security forces to counter them, what are your biggest concerns? I mean, I read an article you wrote recently about that kind of battle in Iraq. Of various kind of Iraqi security forces sort of trying to beat back a slightly resurgent ISIS. We saw a story recently where what seemed like a very senior convoy of Iraqi military officers were killed. But what do you think is going to be what ISIS will do? Will it be sort of, you know, carrying out suicide bombings and then retreating into hiding, or is it going to be much more overt?
I think we have to understand that there's several different pieces of ISIS and they operate in slightly different ways. I think the groups in Iraq, especially the ones you mentioned, for instance, ambushing convoys and things, some of these are groups, for instance, that have always been there. And they were Sunni jihadist insurgents in 2004, 5, 6, 7. Some of them joined Al-Qaeda and then they joined ISIS. Now, those are villages and areas and rural areas where you just have a long-term hostility to first the Americans and then the government in Iraq, which is a mostly Shiite, mostly partly pro-Iranian government. So you have those groups. They're not going to go anywhere. They can be defeated partly, but it's hard to defeat people that are living in caves or you know, are kind of doing what the Viet Minh did in the Vietnam War, just, you know, people that are kind of peasant by day, fighter by night or something. Then you have all these ISIS people that are in Syria. And I think if we look at them, we find a whole bunch of people who are actually not Syrians. Of ISIS women and children, for instance, I think the 70,000 or so that are whole, there's only like 30,000 Syrians. Most of them are Iraqis and foreigners and people from all over the world, Chechens, Bangladeshis, Tajiks, people from the Caribbean, people from, they say there's about 60 from the UK, children and such. So I think there's the ISIS members that are in the desert areas in, let's say, Syria or some of the foreigners. First of all, they can't go home, some of them. They don't have anywhere to go. Their method of attack, I suppose, will be to try to create areas in the desert they can control and then to carry out, insurgent attacks, ambushes, maybe bombings. ISIS is always trying to update its activity a bit and how its tactics. Like, if we look years ago, they used to do huge bombings and these big spectacular attacks. We haven't seen those recently. Now, so ISIS is always trying to tweak what it's doing. I think it's the local commanders they have are not stupid. They're very good at judging the situation, and they're very good at trying to insert themselves wherever there's a kind of power vacuum, because ISIS understands that most of the other groups involved don't really like each other. And as I said, I wrote that article about northern Iraq, where you have the Kurdish forces, the Peshmerga, and then you have the Iraqi security forces. And even the Iraqi security forces are a bit divided between these Shiite pro-Iranian units and the official forces. ISIS is very good, I think, at studying the landscape and saying, listen, okay, here's an area where we can kind of sit and hang out, and all the groups around us don't basically hate each other more than they hate us.
Right, that's the key. And in terms of resources, I mean, it's something that's maybe not focused on that much, but we know that the caliphate, when it was run, was incredibly well organized, and there was a very strong revenue stream, not just from oil, but from taxes and all sorts of other things around how they ran things. I mean, that money has not disappeared. I'm presuming that money is somewhere. So there is large amounts of resources at their disposal in terms of finance. Is that true?
I'm not sure how true it is if they are kind of disparate in small cells in the desert, because according to the U.S. coalition, most of the ISIS cells that they see, it's a few guys or up to 20 people. So I'm not sure how you move money around if you have to be in such a small group. Now, it's true, when they had the caliphate, they did have a kind of their own system. They were kind of a state. Now, were they able to abscond with gold bars or banknotes? Or I don't know. I would assume, I mean, how do you, if you're just living in a cave with 30 or 40 guys or driving around the desert in a few trucks, how do you transfer money around? I would imagine it must be a bit difficult. So I don't know if the global financial network that once existed is as strong as it was. I would assume it's not.
And just looking at sort of the wider issues, I mean, you know, your book is about America and Iran and the struggle for the Middle East. I mean, looking at what's happened over the last couple of weeks and people making all sorts of very broad statements around what the events of the last couple of weeks mean for sort of US influence, Russia as the new sort of power broker in the Middle East. I mean, how do you see it? I mean, having been there on the ground all this time and talked to the fighters and the Kurds and others, I mean, I assume that their view of the US was not amazing beforehand. I mean, is it definitely your view now that the US's reputation now is really going to be at rock bottom in terms of a reliable ally? And does that mean that Russia is really the power that people can rely on?
I think I had the experience of a maybe unique time, because there is a long-term, let's say, decline or waning influence of the US in the Middle East. And that was set in motion years ago because, of course, you know, Barack Obama also wanted to withdraw a bit from the Middle East. He also tried to get out of Iraq. So it's not just the Trump administration. They come at it from different viewpoints. The Trump administration is more isolationist. The Obama administration was more reticent about the use of American power. But in general, I think people in the Middle East certainly look to the Americans as kind of the giant, big gorilla devil that you know, because people are used to the Americans. But I think many countries in the region are either hostile to the United States or growing to be hostile. So, for instance, Turkey, of course, is a country that is ostensibly a U.S. ally, but in which there's a lot of hostility to the United States. Of course, Iran views the U.S. as its principal adversary besides Israel. I think in Iraq and places like that, many of the groups in Iraq feel over time that they've all been sold out a bit, each one in their own way. Like, for instance, many Shiites in Iraq, I think, celebrated the fall of Saddam Hussein, but they didn't want the Americans to stay. The Sunnis felt kind of like Saddam, but they did like the Americans might be a kind of counterbalance to Iran. The Kurds, of course, have always been pro-American, but they feel that they were sold out in 2017 when the Americans didn't back them in Kirkuk or the referendum. And, of course, they felt that the Americans didn't do anything in Syria about Afrin. And then, of course, this recent kind of chaos. So I don't know. If I was Kurdish, I could understand why, for instance, Russia seems like at least sometimes a more reliable ally. I think that Russia is clearly not the warm and fuzzy ally that anyone really wants, but it's the country that everyone kind of says, okay, with the Russians, I kind of know what I'm going to get. With the Americans, you get kind of nice statements, but you never know if they'll really be there for you the next day. And I think even countries like Saudi Arabia or Israel, for instance, that are America's kind of key allies in the region today, both of them, I think, are very, very reticent about thinking that the American administration keeps changing every few years. You never know what's really going on.
Mm. And in terms of what happens now in Syria, I mean, is this as simple a case of just, you know, Assad wins, Iran is really winning, and this was not even expected like a few weeks ago. Do you think that this is a major turning point, that we're going to see a really big consolidation by the regime, and with that sort of a greater role for Iran in Syria?
I think it's a turning point in other ways, globally, in terms of America looking very weak. But and also American foreign policy is just totally erratic, because it turns out Trump didn't even bother to tell some of the people on his, you know, consult with people that are his Syria advisors. But in terms of the Iran stuff in Syria, I think it's more complicated. Look, Assad regime is quite weak in the sense that it is taking back the country, but the country is fundamentally different than 2010. Assad regime doesn't have very many soldiers. It has real serious problems. And how's it going to rebuild the country? The Russians are there. The Russians are not a huge footprint. They just look strong. So the Iranian card is an interesting one. I think that Iran wants to use Syria certainly as a place that it can put down bases and transfer weapons to Hezbollah and perhaps threaten Israel, which, of course, is Israel's main concern in terms of what's happening there. But if we've watched the Iranian media for the last 2 weeks, they've been very careful about not overplaying their hand, and because I think they don't want to look like they're celebrating the American withdrawal, because they're worried that Trump's people might get him to stay. So they're hoping the Americans will kind of quietly go home, and then the Iranians can then exploit that. But the way in which they exploit it, I think, is kind of long-term. Iran would like to have long-term roots in certain little areas along the, for instance, the Iraq-Iran border, strategic areas, where they would then have a base or have Shiite militias and things like that.
Mm. Yeah, and just finally, I mean, I want to just sort of ask you a specific question about Israel and something about Iran that's been coming up, and get your view on it. There have been some reports this week in Israel about discussions that might take place in the security cabinet about the threat from Iranian cruise missiles. And I wonder if you could just share with me your thoughts on that, because it's a wider regional issue here, that there seems to be a suggestion that the attacks on the Saudi oil facilities were done by Iranian cruise missiles. And then all of a sudden we're getting these stories in Israel about a worry about what capability needs to be increased in Israel to deal with that. Is that a political thing around what's going on with government formation, and maybe it's in various people's interests to sort of talk up a security threat, and that maybe affects the coalition talks? Or is this a very real Israeli military establishment fear that perhaps they don't have sort of the top capability to counter Iranian cruise missiles that they'd like to have? I'm sorry to throw that in, but I just thought you might be the person to help me with that.
Well, I've interviewed several Israel air defense experts and officials about this issue. And I think that according to them, the capability exists in terms of radar and detection and Israel's multi-layered air defense systems to stop cruise missiles. The problem, of course, is that, you know, the attack in Saudi Arabia was complex. It involved cruise missiles and it involved a drone swarm of 25 drones or something, which you can also add to that the fact that Iran is trying to transfer precision guidance to Hezbollah. Precision guided missiles mean not necessarily cruise missiles, but missiles maybe that can maneuver or can hit a very precise target, for instance, strategic facilities like the airport or the ports. I think Israel's concern should be not one or two cruise missiles, which I think can probably be stopped or hopefully stopped, but it's having a whole bunch of these things at the same time. And I think certainly the Iranian attack on Saudi Arabia was complex enough that Israel must be a bit concerned. And of course, you know, we know that Iran has tried to test the air defenses before here. Iran sent a drone into Israel airspace in February 2018. Israel used an Apache helicopter to take it out. Iran or Iranian assets in Syria have fired rockets at Israel several other times, I think May 2018, January 2019, and then last month, where they attempted to. So, you know, the Iranians are doing different things like that. But, you know, the question is, you know, would, for instance, Hezbollah or Iranians try to do a preemptive strike on Israel like that? Is that something that's in the cards, or would it come in the context of rising tensions or something like that? I think that, you know, certainly that's the math that Israel has to look at, and it has to, of course, prepare. It has all this air defense, like Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow, Patriot. It has all sorts of technology. I mean, Israel probably has some of the best air defense technology in the world. So if there's a country that can stop it, it should be Israel. But, you know, it obviously means trying to make sure and fine-tune certain things like the David Sling to make sure that actually that will stop a missile that, for instance, can maneuver through valleys or fly very low or go out to sea and things like that.
Well, that would make sense. Seth, I mean, thank you so much for all your insight. I mean, I just want to say to our listeners that, you know, if you are looking for a really solid, both firsthand account, but also a kind of strategic overview, then, you know, do look up Seth's book, After ISIS. It's probably one of the best sort of, you know, recaps on what's happened over the last few years and this kind of ISIS phenomenon. So do look that up and do get yourself a copy. But in the meantime, Seth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.